call to order this hearing of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee on Wednesday, March 11th, 2009. Members have the minutes from the March 9th meeting, which I request that you look over.
Also move them, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel moves approval of the minutes of Monday, March 9th. All who may be in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved as presented. The first bill on our agenda is Senate File 815, Senator Berglund. Welcome to the committee. Senator Berglund has a delete all amendment, author's amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, it's an A2 amendment.
We'll wait until members get it. You have a copy, Senator Berglund?
Yes.
For yourself? Where is everybody? In a corner. Okay. Senator Betzel moves adoption of the A2 amendment. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have the bill in the form that the author wishes us to consider it. Senator Berglund.
So, Madam Chair and members, I've been working pretty hard this session trying to find ways to save money either for the state or for the programs that are receive funding through my division. Because of the budget deficit, this is sort of a big priority for me this year. And one of the ideas that I came up with was that if we were all purchasing medical supplies and equipment together, the state and private providers that, you know, serve a lot of our clients, we could get better prices. And so that's why I had drafted the original bill. But then I learned since then that we already have a Minnesota Multi-State Government Contracting Alliance. Mm-hmm. And that they do some purchasing of medical supplies and equipment. With this bill, I'd like to see them expand the number of items that they purchase. And the other purpose of the bill would be to allow private organizations to voluntarily be purchasing through that program if they choose to do so. Right now, it's only limited to government entities. So, for example, if you're a government-owned nursing home, you could purchase through this purchasing alliance, but if you're a privately owned nursing home, then you couldn't. And in my budget, they're all the same. I mean, they're really all in the same. They all have the same difficulties, and they're all serving the same type of clients. So for that reason, I think it would be a good idea to remove that prohibition.
You have a couple of testifiers?
Yes, I have Carrie Thurlow with me from the Aging Services of Minnesota, and then there's folks from the Department of Administration who would like to talk about their program that they currently have so people could understand it better.
Okay. Ms. Thurlow?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is excuse me, Carrie Thurlow. I represent Aging Services of Minnesota. Aging Services of Minnesota represents Minnesota nonprofit nursing homes in the state of Minnesota. We also represent other continuing care providers, including those providing independent senior housing, assisted living, some home care providers. And so many of the providers under this particular legislation would be afforded the opportunity to benefit from Senator Berglund's legislation. We want to speak in support of the legislation. In these times of tight economic times and tight budgets, our members are always looking for opportunities where they can receive competitive pricing for their supplies, including medical equipment. There are other group purchasing organizations in the state, and this provides yet another option, so we believe could potentially provide additional competitive pricing opportunities for our members, and to that extent that we can hold down costs in providing quality services for seniors. We are supportive of this piece of legislation.
Thank you very much. Are there questions or comments from Ms. Thurlow? Senator Betzel.
A question more of Senator Berglund. Senator Berglund, as you know, the medical supplies and equipment, you know, could cover quite a range, and some equipment could be very expensive, radiological equipment and so forth. It isn't quite defined here. I don't see it, but what kind of equipment were you contemplating?
Well, I was starting to think about, Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, I was thinking about things like incontinence supplies and tongue depressors and not the high-tech stuff. But there are other types of supplies that might be appropriate. I'm sure we have to purchase
blood pressure gauges, things like that.
Right. And, you know, just even manual wheelchairs at the vet's home. And if we're all purchasing, if we can get as many purchasers together as possible, then we should be able to lower the price for the state as well as for our private vendors that we contract with.
Senator Betzold.
Senator, just a suggestion, Senator Berglund, you might, you know, perhaps there's some additional language you could consider disposable items or items for personal use or individual use so that we're not talking about x-ray machines or whatever, because I'm not quite sure that, you know, I wouldn't know what this is directing Department of Administration to do, but I think we could kind of narrow it down to some field of types of equipment that you're looking at. So.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, I would tend to agree with you. They are purchasing some supplies now, but it's not everything that we could be doing. And so I'm trying to get the number of items that they purchase expanded,
right,
as well as allow our private folks that we contract with to serve our clients to be able to take advantage of it as well.
Sure. Thank you.
Senator Betzold, do you have any suggestion for Senator?
Well, Merkel? Madam Chair, I think I'd like to hear from the department and see what their thoughts are, and maybe we can get some better idea what they can and cannot do.
Mr. Rhodes? Thank you, Ms. Thurlong. Mr. Rhodes?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Rhodes, Department of Administration. First of all, the MCAP program, just a little background, is 46 states, plus Chicago and plus Los Angeles, that do procurement of pharmaceuticals and medical supplies. And the idea of expanding it is great. We don't have a problem with that. Our concerns actually, and we've had a conversation with Senator Berglund, and we're still trying to sort it out, with the state and federal antitrust issues, because it's going to the private sector as well as the public sector nonprofits. Right now, we service them all around the country, and with lots of things, and we can add some of the things that we had talked about. It's supplies. It's more than equipment. I guess that would be the key. It's not equipment as to machinery and that type of thing. But the question comes up where our concern is that for the public sector. And I don't know if anybody can answer that or not.
And Madam Chair, I guess the way I look at it is that this wouldn't really get involved with antitrust at all, because it's not private providers getting together and colluding to fix prices. It's simply the government doing something, and we would be allowing the private sector to take advantage of it. And I don't believe anyone has ever defined that to be antitrust.
Senator Betzold?
Madam Chair, and Mr. Rhodes, as I understand your testimony, the term supplies is not as problematic, but the term equipment, is that what you indicated?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, I am not an expert on this, but from what I'm gathering here, it says hospital and medical supplies. And dental supplies. To me, that doesn't mean an x-ray machine. And I don't think Senator Berglund is thinking about that either.
But do you ever do blood pressure cuffs?
Mr. Rhodes. Senator Berglund, I don't know for sure, but we'll have to check and get back to you as this bill progresses along. I really don't know to what extent, but it's a lot of stuff.
Is this like the shared services?
What is this? Senator Berglund, do you understand medical to include things like dental and chiropractic, mm-hmm, and things like that?
Mm-hmm.
It's a broad term.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
Senator Betzold?
Well, I think there's the opportunity to do it. I think we've highlighted the issue. I don't know that I've got quite the answer to it, but I think that certainly the Department of Administration and Senator Berglund can come up with at least identify the things that they think they can get and see if that matches what she's looking at. But I just think that the terms medical supplies and equipment is a bit too much broad of a directive to give the Department of Administration right now, and I think that they can help sort out. But if they don't know right now what it is that they're capable of doing, I don't know that I can offer any language to tighten it up. But I think we'll have to visit at some point.
Senator Berglund?
So, Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I actually think they have the authority to purchase equipment now.
Okay.
My language here is just to get them to do more of a variety of things than they do already.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I mean, we're directing, they shall expand the program, and it must include a full range of medical supplies and equipment. So if somebody, you know, uses that language and, you know, says, Department, you should have, you know, the legislature directed you to do it. Why didn't you get, you know, the kind of equipment that I need? You know, I mean, why invite problems and questions like that if we can, you know, identify exactly what we want them to do? Because I don't know what a full range of medical supplies and equipment would be.
Yeah. Well, it would be more than what they purchase already, which is,
okay,
in terms of the supplies and equipment area, it's pretty narrow compared to what we could be doing to get better prices, both for our institutions and for those that we contract with.
And Madam Chair,
Mr. Rhodes,
members of the committee, we think it's a great idea to expand it. We don't need a mandate to expand it. We're happy to continue on. I guess I'm not sure the parameters. What I may be thinking of, what our department may be thinking of, what Senator Berglund may be thinking of, may be different. And if we can hone that into maybe more so we are all on the same page, that's fine with us. I don't know. Our issue basically deals with to the public sector, whether we can do that or not. And that we have to scope out.
Madam Chair, I think just to be really clear about this, I am not talking about pharmaceuticals.
Yes, that's clear. It does not say that. Yes.
Right. They do purchase pharmaceuticals for government entities, but we cannot expand that to the private sector. But the other things that they purchase, we could, and I think we should.
Okay. This bill, if it advances, goes to the Finance Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether it would go to both divisions, since it involves a commissioner of administration, whether it goes to Senator Betzold or whether it goes to your division or both. But once it gets to finance, you all might want to have a conversation about where it's appropriate, so that further work can be done on it to satisfy Senator Betzold's concerns, which I think are very real ones. It looks like we need more information that could be best provided in the Committee on Finance. Okay. So with that, Senator Marty moves that Senate File 815 as it would be recommended to pass. Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 815? Seeing none, you've heard the motion.
The motion was to pass.
Hmm? To move to finance. You've heard the motion. All those in favor, Senate File 815 passing as amended and being referred to finance, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Berglund. Sometimes, once again, I just need a second to finish the motion. Senator Pretner Solon, is she here?
Yes.
Oh, there you are. Hi. Senator Pretner Solon brings us on Senate File 545.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a bill that seeks to further define psychologists' current practice and activities. And while this legislation has three parts, the section that this committee will be concerned with is Section 2, which modifies the membership of the Healthcare Reform Review Council. This section adds a psychologist to the council, which reflects the indivisibility of mental health and physical health and the important role that psychologists play in our healthcare system. And with me today is Dr. Tricia Stark, excuse me. who is the Director of Professional Affairs for the Minnesota Psychological Association. And we're both happy to answer any questions the committee may have on the
Stark,
membership.
Welcome to the committee, if you'd like to say a few words.
Thank you.
You need to identify yourself, please.
Yes. For the record, my name is Dr. Tricia Stark. I'm a licensed psychologist and Director of Professional Affairs for the Minnesota Psychological Association. There are no behavioral health professionals on the Health Care Reform Review Council. And as I think we all know, behavioral health is inextricably linked with physical health. And the chronic conditions that have been outlined in the health reform, one of those is depression. And we know that it also affects other chronic illnesses. And, you know, the aim is to reduce healthcare costs. And by including behavioral health and a behavioral health professional in the oversight or of the health reform process, I think that information and that input can be very useful. And it could be possible to look at this as a sort of Me Too kind of thing, but I think it's different than that, and that behavioral health input is really crucial in this council.
Senator Pittman-Solon, I realize this is a change to a board. If this was new legislation, it wouldn't meet our guidelines, by the way, but I wonder if you would want to put in terms of the effective date, a time certain when this member would join this health care reform review council, say within 60 days after the bill is passed, the member has to be appointed?
That would be acceptable, Madam Chair.
It won't change any of the rest of it, but it then takes it out of limbo about when the person would need to be on board. Or 30 days, if you like. 60 days, that sound reasonable?
That's 60 days.
Mr. Bonner?
Madam Chair and members, I think you'd want to add a new Section 4 on page 3 of the bill that would say, put the head note deadline for appointment on it, and it would read, the Minnesota Psychological Association must complete the appointment required under Section 2 no later than 30 days after the effective date. 60 days, excuse me, after the effective date.
And that would be non-codified, right?
Correct.
Right. Let's see. Senator Olsen moves that amendment. Is it clear? Any discussion?
And Madam Chair, I take it they're going to track this bill so they will know that they have that. I mean, the author is going to be working with them, so they will know when it's signed by the governor and they know the clock is ticking then.
Well, it's 60 days after enactment. Passage of the enactment, and the enactment date is silent, so it would be 60 days after August 1st, so by, right?
Correct.
So it would be by October 1st.
Oh, okay.
Because there's no effective date. It's not effective.
Right.
As soon as he signs it,
yes, I'm sorry.
It's silent on the effective date. So that would be August 1st.
August 1st.
It would be
gotcha.
September. So by October 1st,
gotcha.
It would be. Mr. Bottom, would you read the language again for the clerk here?
Madam Chair and members, it would be a new Section 4 with a headnote deadline for appointment. It would read, the Minnesota Psychological Association must complete the appointment required under Section 2, no later than 60 days after the date of enactment.
Could we just say October 1st?
I'm sure you certainly could. That would probably be a little easier to understand. No later than October 1st, 2009.
Okay, you've heard Senator Olsen's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion or questions for Senator Pittman-Solon or Dr. Stark about the Health Care Reform Review Council and its membership? Senator Olsen.
Maybe it's not an appropriate question, Madam Chair. I was going to ask about Section 1, the new language
I'm not sure what that means, but that's not something that we're looking at, is it?
She could probably tell you what it means. So.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, what we're trying to do is to put into language what is already common practice, and that is that, and it just specifies, there has been discussion about this. It was already reviewed by Health and Family Security, and that is that a psychologist is permitted to talk to their patient about the medications they're on and the side effects, and then to talk with their physician or put it in their record. It is in no way says that they can prescribe.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olsen.
If I may ask a question, I was on a multiple county mental health board, and they had trouble getting psychologists, and they were using nurse practitioners and all this kind of stuff. How would that be affected by this, or would it be affected?
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, it would not. There are nurse practitioners or I think sort of CRNs or something that can prescribe, actually. And nurses can talk with their patients about medications. This is just for psychologists.
Okay.
Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 545 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there anyone who wishes to comment on in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, you've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye. And
aye.
The bill has been amended before. All those opposed, the motion prevails. Senate
Thank
File 545 is amended. Sent to the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Higgins. State Interoperability Executive Committee Designation. That's a mouthful.
Madam Chair and members, I have Senate File 872. It is a bill that seeks to codify in state law the governor's executive order numbered 07-15. Since the signing of this order, the statewide radio board created the Interoperability Committee, which is made up of more than 30 public safety emergency response organizations that represent federal, local, state, tribal governments and non-government organizations from across the state. The Interoperability Committee is an advisory committee to the Statewide Radio Board / Statewide Interoperability Executive Committee, called the SIEC, and has been functioning since January of 2008. The creation of the Statewide Interoperability Executive Committee was a requirement by the FCC. The Statewide Radio Board, as Minnesota's SIEC, will have the responsibility to develop and maintain a statewide plan for local and private public safety communications interoperability that integrates with the emergency operation plan for the state. Specifically, they will develop and adopt guidelines and operational standards, promote coordination and cooperation among state, local, federal, tribal public safety agencies, and advise relevant departments and committees. And along with me today is Scott Wiggins, who is the director.
And Senator Higgins, you have also a repealer?
Sorry, say it again?
Repealer.
Mr. Wiggins can tell you all about it.
Madam Chair and members.
Section 3 is a repealer. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, Scott Wiggins, the Director of the Division of Emergency Communication Networks at the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. The repealer is leftover language from when there was a planning committee. This is before the development of the statewide radio board. And the section that's actually being repealed, or the subdivision that's being repealed, is really not relevant anymore, as the membership that's listed in that particular portion of the law are really members of the existing statewide radio board and participate in all facets of our governance structure.
Senator Higgins, I understand that in Section 1, you're just designating the statewide radio board to be this entity, and then giving them duties. correct?
Yes.
And then in section 2, you say that the system project plan must include, and then in 4, an interoperability committee. And who are they?
Madam Chair, the Interoperability Committee is an advisory committee to the Statewide Radio Board / Statewide Interoperability Executive Committee. And it has been functioning since January of 2008 by order of the governor.
So it's the same committee, in the Interoperability Committee in number 4 at 217, the same as the committee that you're talking about in section 1?
Madam Chair, one is Mr. Wiggins. We'll help Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and members, it's got kind of a nice ring to it.
Got a ring to it, doesn't it?
Madam Chair and members, the Statewide Radio Board and the Statewide Interoperability Executive Committee are the same group. And the reason for that is we already had...
That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking the relationship between the Statewide Radio Board / the Interoperability Executive Committee and the Interoperability Committee on 217. Is that the same group?
Madam Chair, members, the Interoperability Committee is a standing committee under the Statewide Radio Board.
And who's on it?
The Interoperability Committee. That's the committee that's made up of approximately 30 public safety officials. That would be city, county, state, federal individuals. It'd be non-government organizations such as EMS entities. There's FBI, Secret Service.
And where are they defined in the statute? You understand what I'm asking? I mean, you say you're setting up a committee that you're not telling us who's on it, how they get appointed, anything about them, unless they already exist. Do they already exist?
Madam Chair, that's correct. They exist as a result of the governor's executive order, where it indicates that we would bring this particular group of people together. And the actual makeup of the committee is at our discretion. And what we tried to do with the makeup of that committee and why it's such a large committee is we tried to involve every single public safety entity in the state of Minnesota that would have a need for interoperable communications.
And who are they appointed by?
It's not an appointment process, Madam Chair. It is the Statewide Radio Board has developed the makeup of that particular committee. It's been approved by them.
I think we need some language that identifies who this group of people is. That's what I'm getting at, Senator Higgins. It just says that the communication system project plan must include an interoperability committee, comprised of. We need a little bit more specificity here.
And Madam Chair, the Interoperability Committee is a standing committee under the Statewide Radio Board, and the membership of the Statewide Radio Board is defined in state law. So the Interoperability Committee cannot, they are a recommendation committee, a standing committee, the overall Statewide Radio Board, and their membership, again, is defined in law.
Okay, so can we have at least a statutory reference here to where that occurs, Mr. Bonner?
Madam Chair.
I mean, it doesn't say where they come from.
Madam Chair, I think on 217, after the word committee, you could say made up of members of the Statewide Radio Board.
Mr. Williams?
Madam Chair, this Interoperability Committee is broader membership than the overall Statewide Radio Board. Again,
if we could know where the authority for it is, then we could just make a reference to the statute for where this Interoperability Committee is set up, and if it's done like under the authority of something or other, under the radio board's authority, then they can have their own rules for what it's going to be. Otherwise, this interoperability committee could be you and me, unless we cite the authority for it.
And that would be 403.36, Madam Chair.
Mr. Bonnern, help me here.
Madam Chair,
making a mountain of a mole.
What I think when you're looking at page, the clause 4 and page 2,
yes.
It may be helpful to think of that as a delegation to the statewide radio board to form an interoperability committee as it sees fit. In effect, this is one advisory board that's been given the authority to create an advisory group to advise it.
Okay, so I wouldn't need to have any more specificity here as far as you're concerned.
Madam Chair, no, you'd be delegating the authority to constitute the committee as they see fit.
Sometimes we have committees that are set up that nobody knows who's on them. They don't know when they meet. They don't know who has the authority to appoint them or anything. So that's what I was looking at here. Are there questions for Senator Higgins or Mr. Wiggins?
Madam Chair, it
Senator
has to
Higgins,
go to judiciary.
The Judiciary Committee has requested your bill. Senator Olsen moves. Senator Olsen?
Except, Madam Chair, that I thought you had a pretty good idea there. Are we going to put some language in there?
No. Mr. Bonnern indicates because of the section of law that it's already in, we don't to talk about the authority of them to have this interoperability committee would be redundant.
Okay. I'll move this bill.
Senator Olsen moves Senate File 872 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor of that motion, unless there's someone who wishes to speak on this bill in the audience. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is passed. Thank you very much, Senator Higgins.
Thank you very much.
We now have Senator Kubley, Senate File 999. We have before us the first engrossment. It has to deal with licensure for medical laboratory science professionals. And Senator Kubley, I understand you do need an amendment to
I
bring
do
the
have
bill
an amendment,
to,
and Senator Carlson
with
offered
our,
to.
With our guidelines. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Senator Carlson did agree to offer that for me.
Okay, and is that the only issue that brings the bill here? Okay, so we will deal with the A5 amendment. Senator Carlson offers it. Senator Kubley, you want to explain it, what it does?
Well, the A5 amendment, Madam Chair and members, makes a few changes to the bill. I understand that this committee deals primarily with Section 6, but there is another section that is added toward the end of the bill. But it deals primarily with the term of the appointment for members of the advisory council, who appoints them, an expiration date for the advisory council, and, you know, I guess the commissioner of health gives the commissioner some guidelines on the appointment of those council members, Madam Chair.
Okay, so members should direct their attention to Section 6, and the A5 amendment would bring the Section 6 into compliance with our guidelines. That's the purpose of it. Mr. Bonnern, do you agree that the A5 amendment does that?
Madam Chair, I have used my best efforts to do that. I think it does.
Okay. We have Mr. Bonnern's assurances. Is there anyone who wants to comment on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So, Senator Kubley, would you just tell us a little bit about this advisory council then?
Just the section, Madam Chair.
Just Section 6.
All right.
Unless you need to make other comments about the overall purpose of the bill, but we're looking just at Section 6.
Well, Madam Chair, the Section 6 of this bill deals with professionals who are working within a laboratory setting, usually in a clinical setting as well. We have, laboratories that are connected to hospitals and some that are not. I have experience myself working in that capacity, and you know, it's primarily because of that, I think, that I can see a need for doing what the bill asks overall. But primarily the section that this committee deals with is on the advisory council. It just lists the number of members and the organizations that are to be represented on the advisory council and what the advisory council is to do in Subdivision 2, and then the organizational portion of it in Subdivision 3 that talks about, and well, there's been a couple of subdivisions added by the amendment, Madam Chair. But then, you know, who appoints those and the expiration date for that advisory council. I do have a couple of witnesses with me that can either give you more information on the bill as a whole or address specific questions that the committee may have.
So the bill sets up itself, the overarching bill sets up a licensure for these medical laboratory science professionals, and what Section 6 does is to advise the commissioner about what the standards should be and the how to enforce it, and et cetera, et cetera.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Let's see. And is it Mr. Panning?
Yes,
if
Madam
you'd like
Chair.
To just say a word or two about the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm
about the advisory council.
Right, yes. Exactly. My name is Rick Panning. I'm the co-chair of the Minnesota Licensure Committee that developed this bill. We made a decision to house our advisory council as part of the Health Occupations Division of the Minnesota Department of Health. Initially, when this bill was introduced 2 years ago, it proposed a separate board, and we were advised by many of your colleagues to go a different direction. And we debated whether to go with the Department of Health or the Board of Medical Practice. And for allied health professions, it's about a 50-50 split, and we made a decision to go with the Department of Health. And I've worked closely with Tom Hindlemeyer, the director of the Health Occupation Division. So that's the direction we're going, and basically the advisory council would advise the commissioner and the Department of Health on how to verify qualifications of the licensees, how to verify the standards for their education, training, exams, continuing education, determine if they're qualified, enforce the standards of professional conduct, issue the licenses, collect and deposit the fees, approve future certification exams if some come up in the future as our profession changes, and maintain a roster of the names and addresses of the licensees and document their continuing education. And then my colleague, Kathy Hansen, will give you more details about the makeup of the board.
My name is Kathy Hansen. I'm the other co-chair of the Minnesota Laboratory Licensure Coalition. Section 6 of the bill describes the advisory council's responsibilities, and one of the first things that they would be responsible for doing is, since this is a new licensing program, getting information out to the professionals in the state that are affected by this. The Licensure Coalition actually has membership from 10 different stakeholder groups, most of which represent sections of our profession. So we have databases of emails and mailing addresses for folks that work in laboratories that can help us get the word out. Rick already mentioned that the advisory council would advise the commissioner on applications that maybe weren't clear as to what the qualifications of the individual applying were. We feel that the advisory council could do a lot of this work electronically and not have to come for in-person meetings on a frequent basis. and then ultimately advise the commissioner on enforcement and disciplinary actions as well. The members of the advisory board represent the laboratory professional groups that would be licensed under this act, so a non-physician licensed laboratory director, such as Rick or myself, a medical laboratory science professional with a baccalaureate degree, a medical laboratory technician with an associate degree, and then one member representing one of the specialty disciplines licensed under this act, examples of which are cytogenetics and molecular biology. The board would also contain three pathologists with board certification in clinical pathology, and this representation was agreed to after a lot of interaction with the groups that represent pathologists in the state. One physician who is not a pathologist or a laboratory director who would represent the customers of the laboratory and a public member. So this structure was arrived at after examining boards that are in place in other states that license laboratory professionals and seems to be consistent with what's happening elsewhere.
Thank you very much. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Panning or Ms. Hansen? Or Senator Kubley? Seeing none. Oh, seeing some. Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, I was just wondering, how many states currently do this licensing procedure?
Currently, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, currently there are 12 other states in the United States plus Puerto Rico that license laboratory professionals.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Now, I noticed that it said that if another state licensed and they moved here and the licensing procedure was similar, that they could pretty much automatically get a license here. How will you determine the abilities or the qualifications of somebody who has been doing this in another state that is not licensed?
Mr. Panning?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, if I understand your question correctly, if somebody came from another state that either didn't have licensure, and how do we determine that they're eligible? We do have the eligibility requirements for each category in terms of what degree they need to have, what certification they need to have, what level of experience and training they need to have. So that's all been defined for every category. For a person from a state with licensure, because the licensure bills have been modeled against each other quite closely, we're able to recognize and through reciprocity recognize their license. But for each category, we do have the certification, the education, and the training and experience that we would qualify each person by.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling, you're getting a little bit far from our jurisdiction.
Oh, but I haven't heard this bill before.
No, but this is, you can ask your questions, but we really need to concentrate on our jurisdiction, which is their advisory board.
How about cost? How much do you expect the licensing to cost?
Mr. Panning.
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, it's a very good question. We don't have an exact cost at this point. We try based on numbers in our profession, which are relatively similar to the physical therapy profession in this state, to believe that it would be similar to theirs, but we haven't had a fiscal note yet because we haven't been to finance to determine that. So I don't have an answer. And it's the same question my professionals keep asking me, but we can say approximately we think it'll be near this, but we don't know at this point.
Senator Roebling, if you look at the summary in Section 17, they start talking about the fees in that section in the bill. Senator Gerlach, did you have a question or a comment? Is there further discussion on the advisory group?
Madam Chair.
Senator,
I'll move the bill.
Senator Vickerman will move the bill. Is there,
Madam Chair?
Just a moment.
Yeah, that's okay.
Is there anyone else who wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill, first of all? Okay, then Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The department has asked that the dates in Section 18 of the amendment that was added be changed to a little bit later date. They're requesting September 1 of 09 on line 114, and on line 115 change August to October.
So would you say again, please?
Sure.
Please swing right down.
On the amendment that was passed out, the A5 amendment, section 18, line 1.14, change July 1 to September 1, and on line 1.15, change August 1 to October 1.
Yes, otherwise you'd be having the appointments required before the bill was effective.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Senator Carlson moves on the A5 amendment that line 114 begin to strike July 1 and insert September 1, and on line 115 to strike August 1 and insert October 1. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment to the A5 amendment is adopted. Further discussion? Because the bill involves some civil penalties in the section 16, the Judiciary Committee has requested the bill. Senator Carlson moves that Senate File 999, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Cooley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members.
Ms. Hanson. We next have Senate File 487, Senator Clark.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. The in front of you today, you have the Office of Early Learning. This is something that we passed last year. It is in a slightly different form, but because we're in a new biennium, we obviously are back here, and it's something that we are working on in the Education Committee right now. It's actually probably in at least 5, if not 6, bills. It's one of the things that the Early Childhood Caucus has been working on. And if it's okay, Madam Chair, I'm going to just make a few comments, and then we can address. We'll try to make. I'm assuming you don't have much time. You've got a pretty long.
Yeah, well, maybe you need to just say what this office is going to do, what they're supposed to do, what their duties are, et cetera.
Yep. It's a bill to create an Office of Learning that would coordinate Minnesota's early childhood system, especially the programs in the Department of Health and Department of Human Services and Education. Currently, as I think many of you are aware, because many of you have worked on these programs, there are programs scattered throughout the state that touch children's lives, be it ECFE or Head Start in the Department of Education, child care in the Department of Human Services, among others. The director of the office that we're proposing, this is based largely on a model in Pennsylvania, would be appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate and responsible for coordinating the department's efforts that coordinate funding streams, enabling departments and the array of early childhood programs to work together more efficiently, create common standards for quality and rules for training, leading to better accountability across programs, be an effective clearinghouse for up-to-date accessible information on early care and education for all stakeholders, enhance the ability of early education programs to deliver high-quality services. We want to build on the strengths of the current system, minimizing weaknesses and maximizing resources, and provide for timely and comprehensive information to the governor and legislature for cohesive decision-making. Essentially, sometimes we have things in front of us that are about moving deck chairs or moving bodies around and saying that's reform. That's not what this is about. We truly have some ongoing challenges between departments and the knowledge they have and the programs that they work with. And our belief in what has been seen in many states that have done something like this is that we will start seeing not just better communication, but more thoughtful and integrated ways of doing work. Now, I want to compliment the departments. They have been working very hard the last few months trying to figure out how to get past some of what might be perceived as turf or systems or other things, but we do believe that this is something that would make a big difference. So what you have in the bill in front of you is actually a director that would be working with both of those departments. We know that there are other programs and other agencies that we would want them to connect with, but those would be the main things. Now, in Pennsylvania, they did not initially move, and we would not put in this that they had to move somewhere. We believe that they will naturally figure out what's the best location, but the important thing is that they are thinking comprehensively of the whole child. And so what you see in front of you is the types of things that they would be working on. And again, these are the types of services and framework that we have been engaged with. There's another bill that would relate with this. We're working on a framework right now that would help parents have a better understanding of what services somebody was offering, the level of the quality, how it relates to what the research shows. And that's what you see in here about the framework and the system. That's another piece that the caucus has been working on. And frankly, part of our goal is that we think if we are streamlining some services on the state level and get people getting past maybe some of the disconnect, that we will help those on the local level do a better and more effective job as well. And frankly, Madam Chair, we think they can do this with existing staff.
Mr. Bodden would like a word with you.
Thank you. I didn't actually, I forgot that we didn't have it. We have an A1 amendment, okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Clark has it. Is it a delete all?
It's a delete all.
Delete all.
And actually, what it does is it streamlines what's in front of you. There was some duplication of what's on there.
Let's
get
it,
Madam
and then
Chair.
We will.
This has been one of those fast paced afternoons.
Take it up.
We've been running all over the place.
So on behalf of the author, Senator Carlson moves the A1 amendment.
Well, Madam Chair, is this the Committee of Origin? I don't think it is, though.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, this was referred here from education. It will go back to education. We are working on this as part of a larger bill, and we thought that if it came here.
Has the bill been heard?
No, it hasn't. It was referred here so that we could go ahead and hear this part of the bill.
So this is actually the even though it was referred elsewhere, it's not been heard yet, so that was a re-referral on
yes.
the floor?
Yes.
Senator Betzel?
Yes, Senator Betzel. We did that on the floor, I believe it was last week.
It was, yeah, Madam Chair, it was initially referred to the Education Committee, but was withdrawn
and referred and here.
Re-referred here, so
yes.
this is the committee of origin.
So Senator Carlson moves on behalf of the author of the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is.
Madam Chair, I actually noticed there was one word that was left on here that should have been deleted. If I could bring that to your attention, and perhaps Senator Carlson or somebody else, just so we could get it where I thought it was on 1.9. The comma, health comma, should be deleted. It's the Departments of Education and Human Services.
Senator,
home visiting is in health, and at some point that might make sense,
typo.
But we wanted to focus on the actual early care and education programs.
Senator Carlson moves on line 1-9 of the A1 amendment, again on behalf of the author, to delete health, comma.
Oh, health.
All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I've got a question.
Senator Clark, would you, now that we've adopted it, would you just kind of explain how you streamline it? And then I'll go to Senator Betzel for a question, because I also had a question about some language that was on the
There was 11 bill. Different, I believe there was 11 different items that it said the person would be doing, and we thought that some of them were a little redundant, so we were trying to collapse them. We also were building off of the language that's in the quality rating system bills that we're working on, which is where the first part about what the office would be doing in terms of coordinating high quality early childhood system in Minnesota, making programs more effective. And improving the educational outcomes. Part of what's being done here, and I don't know how much, since some of this is really obviously things the Education Committee will be talking about, is that we want to make sure that parents have choices in their local communities, that they are sensitive to a variety of the values that parents have and different cultures. We want to make sure that we are building off of the research that is out there. We want to make sure we're getting the best use out of public dollars. Obviously, we do not have any kind of a mandatory system in this state, and that's not what this is about. But what it really does is instead of people perhaps over in human services or people over in education thinking specifically about the settings in which the children that they're seeing come in, this could start us thinking about a child as a child as a child, and that regardless of where they may be receiving child care or participating in Head Start or in a school program, that we are expecting and hoping for the same kinds of things.
Senator Betzel.
Just a question. The on lines 1.6 and 1.7 says the governor must appoint and the Senate must confirm. If the Senate chooses not to confirm, what do we do? We don't like the person.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, if you have a suggestion of a different word in there, that is quite fine. This has been a work in progress with the House, and I honestly do not remember who originally.
Senator Clark, I think there is some boilerplate language that we use when we're talking about the advice and consent of the Senate.
Subject to Senate confirmation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that we should be using the boilerplate language.
Mr. Bonner.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Betzold's suggestion is well taken. You could delete on line 1.6 and the Senate, and on line 1.7 delete must confirm and insert subject to the advice and consent of the Senate.
So moved.
You've heard Senator Betzold's motion to amend the A1 amendment. Any questions? All those in favor of the amendment that's just been read by Mr. Bodden, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment to the amendment is adopted. Are there any other questions for Senator Clark? Otherwise, we can hear from your witness.
Thank you. I have Ms. Kingsley from Ready for K.
Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Karen Kingsley. I'm the Policy Director at Ready for K, and we're a nonprofit group that's dedicated to making sure that all kids in Minnesota arrive at kindergarten ready to succeed. Ready for K is also the manager of the BUILD Project, which is a national initiative working with states to help create more comprehensive early childhood systems. And so we've been working on this for the past 7 years of thinking about what does a system require and need. And one of the most critical components is how do we have a governance structure that really helps the system come together and work efficiently so it's getting the results that we want. And an Office of Early Learning would be a critical part of that kind of governance structure that's going to help us create the kind of accountability that we need across agencies. One of the things that we have right now, as Senator Clark mentioned, is a number of programs administered primarily by the two agencies of Education and Human Services, but they're not organized around one shared common goal. And an Office of Early Learning would really move us far towards having those programs aligned towards a common goal. And it would really create this kind of direct link between the agencies that have jurisdiction and help foster the kind of collaboration and the best practices that we need to make sure that the system is moving forward in a really efficient way. One of the things I want to mention is that an office would allow for both what we would call horizontal alignment across systems and programs that serve the same children, like Head Start and School Readiness that are from the Department of Education and Child Care Assistance that's now in Human Services. But it would also allow for kind of vertical alignment to help us think about the children who are 0 to 5, and then obviously as they age, how they integrate into the other systems that the state is working on. Just to give you a little bit of a national perspective, there's 8 other states that have created either separate departments or a freestanding office focused on early care and education. And what we've heard from those other states is that having such an office has really elevated the focus on early childhood. It's helped the state stay focused on the goals that we're trying to achieve, particularly in terms of getting kids ready for school. And it has helped us not get those programs lost in the larger departments of education and human services. And again, what we've heard from other states is that now we have a single place to go if we have any kind of issue around early childhood, that we have administrative cost savings often because more funds are available for the programs as we're avoiding duplication, we're streamlining application process, we're having the kinds of quality standards that are clear that apply across the board, like having an application form that is the same instead of having multiple forms from multiple departments when, in fact, we're delivering the same kind of service. One of the things I really like about Senator Clark's bill is that it creates an office is connected to both departments. It doesn't create a separate freestanding department that then gets disconnected from the other programs that children need as they age. And again, in Pennsylvania, which this this bill is based on, they've really had a lot of success in helping to identify the common goal that we're all searching for, and an office has helped them move that way. And we are very strongly in support of this bill. We think it's something that's going to create the right kind of structure that moves us towards getting kids ready for kindergarten and for success in school and life. And I'd be glad to answer any questions if there are any. Thank you.
Any questions for Senator Clark or Ms. Kingsley? Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to speak either in support or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Roebling has a question. Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 487, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you
very much, Senator Clark. Senator Latz. Senator Latz brings us Senate File 82. Senate File 82 is the False Claims Act. This is not the. You have a delete all amendment, but this is not the first committee, so.
No, I don't think I have a delete all amendment for this.
Get to another bill. Oh, I see. The last summary was done to a delete everything amendment, which then became the first engrossment.
Correct.
So is the
surprise me,
is
Madam.
The bill summary that has the title "Authors Delete Everything Amendment" include everything that is in the first engrossment?
I believe so.
Yes.
I believe so.
Just
yes.
Because members are going to refer to it, we want to make sure that whatever's in there. is actually in the language.
Yes.
And the bill comes to...
Actually, Madam Chair, there were two minor amendments that were...
That might not be reflected in the delete all...
Wouldn't be reflected
in the
delete
all summary.
Delete everything.
Okay.
Amendment.
And the... this bill, Senator Letts, can you tell me where this bill has been before?
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Where did it go before?
It was in Judiciary.
Judiciary, okay.
It's Committee of Origin.
Is this the second stop?
This is the second stop.
Okay. And what brings the bill to this committee?
Madam Chair, I understand that Section 14 of the bill is the only provision in the bill that would implicate this committee's jurisdiction. Section 14 provides for basically some workplace protections against retaliation for a whistleblower under the False Claims Act. If you want, Madam Chair, I can give a 30-second description of the basics of the bill so that it fits into context, or I can just concentrate on Section 14.
Probably we need a little bit of a general introduction.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The False Claims Act that's proposed before you is modeled on the Federal False Claims Act that's been in effect since President Lincoln proposed it after the Civil War. It basically provides a financial incentive for a person inside an organization that is submitting false billings or underpaying bills relating to the government, a financial incentive for that person who has that knowledge to come forward and expose the fraud against the taxpayers. The financial incentives that they get to share in the recovery. So if, for example, a company is falsely billing the state, these often come up in Medicaid fraud cases as the most dominant category, they notify law enforcement, the Attorney General's office, or whomever it is. And if there's a recovery of ill-gotten taxpayer dollars, then a portion of that recovery gets paid to the whistleblower. Because it's usually a career-ending decision, it's a very large decision for an employee to make. So there's that financial incentive for them to come out of the shadows and make that report, and they have some financial cushion. We had a full committee day on this in front of the Judiciary Committee, had a lengthy testimony, and it was passed in its present form to this committee. One of the amendments that was in the Judiciary Committee.
Senator Gerlach?
It's quite Senator Ladd's.
One of the amendments that was in the Judiciary Committee deleted the state government or political subdivisions from being potential defendants in an action such as this. That was in response to the Attorney General's office concerns about in other capacities representing government agencies and then having maybe to take on a claim against a government agency. And that was not the core of the bill. The real target is private organizations that are falsely billing the state. So what we're left with in terms of the this committee's jurisdiction is Section 14, which is broadly written to provide essentially whistleblower-type protections in the workplace against retaliations. So if an individual were to blow the whistle on their employer could not take certain retaliatory actions against them. It's written broadly, and I suppose technically it could be read to include the state government as an employer or political subdivisions as an employer. Since the state government could not be a defendant, you would not have a situation where an employee turned in the state defrauding the state. The only fact scenario that we could conjure up, theoretically any, would be if a state employee was aware of a private organization that was defrauding the government, became the whistleblower against that private organization, but that private company had close ties with that employee's supervisor, and that supervisor then might conceivably take retaliatory action against the whistleblower. We're not aware of any cases that have arisen under that scenario, but that's the only theoretical application we could conceive of that this might apply in terms of state or local governments.
Okay, there comments or questions for Senator Lantz at this point? And we'll hear your witnesses, Senator Lantz.
Madam Chair, I have with me Neil Thompson, who was a whistleblower in the Minnesota case. And I also have with me Brian Wadlovich. I pronounce that right? Wadlovich? Sorry, you probably get called lots of things. Or mispronounce your name often, I should say.
True.
I don't want to take up the committee's time with their testimony unless the chair feels that you need a broader discussion on the merits of the overall bill. We're happy to answer questions relating to Section 14 if you wish. If the committee desires, we can certainly provide additional testimony in support of the broader purposes of the bill.
Committee, have any questions for the two gentlemen? Guess not. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A25 amendment.
if I could, Madam Chair, I could maybe give a little preamble to that while it's being handed out.
Let's get it to the author first. Senator Gerlant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't pretend to be an expert in this or in what the, you know, with the Judiciary Committee's proceedings, but I do understand they had a number of amendments and such, and there are some folks that have another modification, another amendment that they'd like to make to this bill, and they approached me, and it seemed very reasonable to me, and I wanted to learn a little bit more about it. So this amendment here does not specifically deal with Section 14, but I would beg the committee's indulgence that if they could at least hear the issue. I think it's very simple, and if we could do that, and then we could have somebody just come and speak in detail to it. But essentially, members, this amendment states that if you've got an internal compliance office, that before someone would go to the state with a claim and be incented to collect a reward, that first they would be routed to the compliance office to resolve the issue and make good or whatever it needs to be done before that, so that there isn't an incentive to run to the state before you deal with this internally. At any rate, but maybe if I could, Madam Chair, Matt Lemke could come up to the table and speak a little bit about his perspective on this amendment, and then, of course, Senator Latz could respond, and then we could make up our minds.
Senator Gerlach, it looks like it's a little bit far afield here, but I'll allow the discussion of it, I guess.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lance.
If you want to go into the discussion, we certainly can if we're going to, because this essentially guts the main thrust of the False Claims Act. Seems to me this amendment is much more properly before the Judiciary Committee, which has already done with its work on this bill. If we're going to go into this, I would like an opportunity to have both of my witnesses testify. We can go into the full purposes of the bill, and we can have the entire discussion about whether we ought to pass a False Claims Act in the state. But just so you know, Madam Chair, in my view, this goes far beyond Section 14, which we were prepared today to address. And I'll ask for ample opportunity to go through all of this.
Senator Gerlach, your response to that? This is not proper for our committee in terms of it changing the whole bill?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess we're not certain if it will. That's the author's contention, but we should probably find out if that is in fact the case. I don't know that it is in fact guts the bill or not. Mm-hmm. So I think the way it was presented to me, I think it was worthy to find out if this is something that would improve the bill.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, it seems to me if we add an amendment or even consider amendment that would affect the work that the Judiciary Committee has already done, then do we have to send the bill back to Judiciary again? I mean, I really don't know. It seems to me an amendment that's outside our jurisdiction would be more properly offered on the floor.
Senator Roebling?
Madam Chair, the problem with going to the floor is we don't have any testifiers. And I, in a way, as long as we have the people who are somewhat expert on this, it might be beneficial to us to hear from them. Otherwise, it may be much more difficult to explain and understand on the floor.
How about this? How about we do hear someone to, in their view, that supports this amendment so that we can have a testimony on it? But I would agree with Senator Pappas that if we put it on, we'd have to go back to Judiciary because this reflects their work. And at that point, if you want to offer it on the floor, Senator Gerlach, that'd be fine. But then I would ask you to withdraw it from here.
Okay, Madam Chair.
We'll hear about it.
Okay, let's
hear
it.
But I think it's a good idea, Senator Roebling. Senator Latz, we're going to just hear from a proponent of the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate your indulgence. My name is Matthew Lemke. I'm with the law firm of Winthrop and Weinstein. I'll be extremely brief.
Mr. Lemke.
We think this is a simple amendment that would allow for an employer's right to cure. One of the reasons, Senator Lass and I did have a rather lengthy discussion about this bill, and he does oppose this bill, just to be, this amendment, just to be very clear. Right. We have a differing opinion of what this amendment would do. What we would like to see happen is the way we feel the bill is currently drafted. Perhaps maybe I should talk about why it wasn't addressed in judiciary first. When it was originally drafted, it was drafted towards, and I did this, towards Section 14 of the bill, which was the employee section. It should have been drafted to the employer section. By the time I really figured out what was going on and we talked about it, the Judiciary Committee had already done its work, so that's why it's here. But again, simply what this amendment would do is would have an employee or a whistleblower try to correct a problem internally with an employer before they would go to the state and try to collect a bounty under the bill as a whistleblower. So what it's trying to do is protect an honest employer that has internal compliance measures to make sure that they're doing the right thing from having a whistleblower action against them before they've had an opportunity to correct the mistake. And I know Mr. Thompson did not testify yet in this committee, but he has in other committees. And under his example, as he's explained it, this amendment would change absolutely nothing. Because my understanding is Mr. Thompson went internally to six or seven supervisors and talked to them, and nothing was done. If that was the case, this amendment would not protect an employer that does something like that in that type of scenario. So thank you very much for your indulgence.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Lemke. Sir, did you want to speak?
Madam Chair, maybe I can explain at least the theory as to why we.
Is the other person sitting there speaking in favor of the amendment?
No, he's not. He's
okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Lemke.
Thank you very much.
Senator Lass, if you'd be very brief, we are not going to take this up, but I do think that Senator Roebling was quite correct in at least asking for some explanation, because the bill will not go back to judiciary, but at least these members here have had an explanation and some testimony on why Mr. Lemke wanted the amendment and offered it to Senator Gerlach. Senator Lass.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. with this amendment, if a person, as defined in the bill, or say a company, were to spend years defrauding the government out of millions of dollars, and their employee who was aware of this notified the company internally, then the company would have an opportunity to cure the defect and avoid all other consequences by simply reimbursing the state for its loss. It would be akin to saying you can go steal a television set out of Best Buy, and if you can get away with it, great. If you get caught, the only penalty is going to be you have to give the television set back. The whole point of the False Claims Act is to provide not only the financial incentive for a whistleblower to come forward, but to create a financial incentive on the fraudulent company, and the company that's falsely billing the state, to detect and prevent, have the systems in place so that doesn't happen in the first place. If they actually go through with it, then they are liable for treble damages, civil damages, a civil penalty, and that is not uncommon in the tort law. The whole theory of tort law is to put the financial incentive on the party that's in the best position to prevent the harm from occurring. And in that case, in this case, that would be the company that's defrauding the government. Now, I would also point out that the liability standard in this bill is for the fraud or for the false billing to be occurring knowingly. Knowing and knowingly is that the party, in this case, say a company, had actual knowledge that it was going on, that they knew they were submitting false bills to the government and did so anyway, that they acted in deliberate ignorance of the truth or falsity of that information, so, or they acted in reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of that information. There's no room in this standard of liability for inadvertence or mistake. no one will become liable because they inadvertently miscoded a bill to the state. Only if they knew what was going on or they deliberately put their head in the sand when they had really good reason to believe it was going on are they going to be liable under this civil standard of liability. And to give them an out, a right to simply cure it and walk away when they happen to get caught by an employee, would completely gut the whole purpose of the False Claims Act before you.
Okay. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak either in support or in opposition to the bill? We've had a little bit broader discussion here, but I hope you'll restrict your comments, if you can, to Section 14.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is David Feinwax. I am General Counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association. I am here to speak in opposition to the bill, and I will attempt to limit my comments to Section 14. We believe that whistleblowers currently have sufficient protection. We believe that the measure in the bill in its entirety is unnecessary. It will cause more expense to the state than it will recover anything. It will create ambiguity, confusion, and increased expense for healthcare providers. And in short, it is unnecessary. I believe there is working its way through the system of fiscal note to this end, which will demonstrate that. But I think in summary, all I can say is it's not needed. We have all of this in place at the federal level. Everything's working fine. There's no need to create new things and new confusion. Thank you.
Are there questions or comments for Mr. Feinwax?
Madam Chair, what is the
Senator
fiscal
Day.
Note?
Pardon?
What is the fiscal note?
The bill next goes to finance, so we don't know that yet. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I appreciate the committee's indulgence in hearing the testimony on the A25 amendment, and I wanted to make sure that that everybody had a chance to at least get their issues heard. So, but I understand the difficulties with the going back to the Judiciary Committee and such. So I'll withdraw the A25 amendment.
Senator Gerlach withdraws the A25 amendment. Are there other questions? Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard on Senate File 82? Seeing none. Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 82, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All who may be in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Marty, Senate File 66. Senator Pappas, you're ready to go? Senator Marty is somewhere else right now.
Okay. What was this, Marty? No, this passed.
Madam Chair, I move the committee.
Hold the whole thing.
Senator Sieben moves the subcommittee report on Senate File 661. All those in favor of Senator Stevens' motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Subcommittee report is adopted. We now have Senate File 661 as amended in the Election Subcommittee before. Senator
Madam Chair, I'll explain the bill, but I do have an amendment, but I seem to have misplaced it. So maybe when the amendment's passed out, just make sure that I get one, too. Oh, wait, this is it, the A4? I found it. Okay. Madam Chair and members.
Would you want to talk about the bill first before
yes.
you dealt with the amendment?
I will.
Okie doke. Senator
Madam
Pappas.
Chair, the bill does basically four major things. First of all, it requires post-secondary institutions to prepare a list of students enrolled in the institution who reside in Minnesota and provide it to the Secretary of State. And then the Secretary of State will match those students with their correct precincts and then forward those lists to the appropriate county attorney so that on election day, the election judges will have a list of students who they know officially reside in the precinct, so it'll streamline the ability of those students to register on Election Day. Section 2 authorizes the Secretary of State to provide a process for online registration. Section 3 is a conforming amendment. Section 4 just specifies the form of voter registration applications to reflect the online voter registration. Section 5 requires the Secretary of State to ensure that voter registration, that the state's website can provide voter registration confirmation to a registered voter, so the voter will know that they have registered. And Section 6 provides some additional conditions that must be met before a city or town clerk can administer absentee voting. Since subcommittee, we have run into some issues, and they have to do mainly with the private colleges, who feel that they like the current system where they have a relationship with their local county auditor and would rather not send that information to the Secretary of State. So we have the A4 amendment, which we could pass out now.
Paige, as I'm distributing it, Senator Pappas, do you want to
begin to explain
what it does to your bill?
It leaves the current law for the private institutions where they may send the list to the county auditor. It deletes student identification number from the language in the bill on page 115 so that the list just includes the student's name and their current address, and it qualifies that at the request of MNSCU by saying as permitted by applicable privacy laws. And that's it. It's just those. Oh, and it says also it requests that the University of Minnesota also complies with this subdivision. That's the third thing the amendment does.
Okay, with this amendment, then, the private colleges do not have objection to your bill? Is that what this amendment?
I believe so, but we can hear from them.
Okay, if someone's here, mm-hmm. speak to it. Maybe we should hear from them before we vote on it then.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess. Madam Chair and committee members, it's been one of those days. My name is Kevin Mann. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Private College Council. We represent the 17 private nonprofit liberal arts colleges in the state. We did have some concerns with the original language. We worked with the Secretary of State's office and the author, and we are fine with the status of the bill with this amendment.
Okay. Are there questions? McMahon, Mr. McMahon, or Senator Pappas about the A4 amendment? Senator Day.
Madam Chair, what didn't you like about the bill that made you want to opt out?
Mr. McMahon.
The issue that we had with it was that as private entities, in essence, engaging in a private interaction between our institutions and the students, we provide data for a number of areas in which we are regulated, primarily around financial aid. Our take was that this was requiring the sharing of private data above and beyond the enterprise of higher education that goes beyond the scope that we felt comfortable with. And one of the issues that we did have is, unlike the University of Minnesota and MNSCU, who have protections on in essence data violation situations, our schools are not indemnified. So if there was a violation caused by a misuse of the data that our schools are sharing regarding our students, the student and or their family could have claims against the schools, which would ultimately put our endowments at risk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Yes. Yep. And as Senator Pappas just requested, the current law allows our schools to opt in to working with their local county officials to help the voting process for students living on campus. And our currently 100% of our campuses participate in this process. And for them, it's
the opportunity to manage the risk that they're going to face. They're able to work with the local folks and go back and forth to work out what's working best for the county and what's working best for the schools.
Is there further a question or comment on the A4 amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, I'm just trying to understand what on your amendment line 1.11, where it says the University of Minnesota is requested to comply with this subdivision, what that means.
Senator Sieben, it's because they have constitutional autonomy and we can't require them to do anything. We can only,
so even though it says
we can only invite them to do it.
Okay.
Anything else in the A4 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Pappas moves that the A4 amendment to Senate File 661 be adopted. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas, on your bill.
I do have one witness, Madam Chair.
Fine.
That's you, Greg.
Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Graham Allen, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota State University Student Association. We represent about 65,000 university students in the state at our seven state universities. This past election cycle, we conducted one of our largest and most successful civic engagement campaigns, and one of the many things that we've done was kind of a voter engagement and a get-out-the-vote effort. And we wanted to just kind of throw in our two cents and support for the changes from Senate File 661, and specifically regarding Sections 1, 2, and 5. The residential housing lists have been a very helpful tool for students living in dorms to be able to register to vote. Students often have had a hard time of producing the sort of documents they need to provide their residents. And Election Day registration is easier when students can show a student ID and be matched to a list that and address that the school has provided. So that's one of the main reasons why it was in place, the provision has been in place. Another thing that we've found is that with the old system, there were some questions about whether or not what is 10 miles within a certain jurisdiction that the school is going to be responsible to providing lists for, what is 10 miles, things like that. This kind of working with the Secretary of State's office, Senator Pappas, for state university students, where most of the dorms are, it makes it a lot easier and less confusing for institutions to decide what their boundaries are and what lists they have to provide. Cutting a lot of this out to save some time. The other thing we just wanted to say is that students also support the provisions that allow online voter registration and a way to check online if an individual is registered to vote. Obviously, online voter registration is a larger issue than just for students, but for students who do a vast majority of their business, be it paying tuition, registering for classes, buying textbooks, and communicating with emailing professors and that kind of stuff, online makes a lot more sense for students. And we found a lot of students that weren't sure if they were registered, and the online provision makes it easier for them to not only register but also to check. And so we support it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Allen. Any questions or comments from Mr. Allen? Thank you very much. Is there further discussion on Senate File 661 from any member? Senator Roebling.
Chair, thank you. I'm just wondering, what if someone shows up who is not on the list, and what are the election judges to think that they haven't lived there, or that they shouldn't be registering, or what kind of proof would they need to register if they aren't on the list?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, but Mr. Allen can address that.
Okay, yeah. Mr. Allen.
The lists don't quite act like a voucher or any kind of official thing. It's more of just kind of a guide. If a student comes in and says, well, I've got all these different things here, I've got, another, it's just another tool, essentially, to help identify that a student lives there. But it's there, I guess if a student's got you know, their student ID and things like that, and the list is provided, then they can vote. If they're not on the list, then they'd have to go through the regular process of providing whatever documentation you need to, you know, your...
It also places them in the right precinct. It serves as a precinct finder, too, to make sure they're not someplace where they shouldn't be.
And I just want to make sure that, you know, that they don't move from precinct to precinct and vote more than once.
Right. And the Secretary of State, who kind of worked with over the summer a little bit on this and then more recently, it would be easier if for the Minsky system, if they can provide all of their housing lists, all their data, essentially, which is can be centrally located and sent to the Secretary of State, parceled out by precinct. It's a lot more convenient and updated, as opposed to each individual campus trying to provide lists and then that being broken up individually and sent to various precincts. It was more just kind of an ease for the system as well as the Secretary of State and election officials.
And there, Senator Roebling, there in the bill too, there are requirements that the Secretary of State's office have the necessary equipment and website sophistication, technical stuff too on just retrieving the information from registered voters as well. If you look at
Madam Chair,
the amendment that is the subcommittee report. Senator Roebling first.
Madam Chair, just a response to Senator Roebling's earlier question. I actually found language in the bill on page 3 that specifies election day registration. I think we all kind of forget, like I did. So you can present a driver's license or Minnesota ID card. A document approved by the Secretary of State is proper identification. We have to ask them about that. A valid student ID, if a list of students from that institution has been prepared. A current student fee statement that contains the student's valid address. And then, of course, a voucher.
Madam Chair, just to that point where you said if available, I'm wondering, Senator Pappas, how close the Secretary of State's office is to having the availability of verifying registration, for example. I mean, it would be a nice tool for a lot of people, not just students, but I'm wondering if they're pretty close to that.
She's here.
Secretary's here, too.
Oh, Secretary of State's here, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was kind of a second issue that I was bringing up in terms of the technical capability to provide voter registration confirmation for any voter, not just the students. Ms. Fraser?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. We have not begun the programming necessary to provide the confirmation of registration because we don't have the authority yet to do it, but we believe that we could definitely have it in place before the 2010 election cycle so that it would be a tool available to voters in that time frame.
Madam Chair, and
Senator Roebling,
and does that also stand for the registration, voter registration online?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I believe so. I need to talk more to our IT people about it, about the timing, but we would hope to have it in place as soon as possible because we know that lots of people are looking for that tool.
Thank you,
Senator Day.
Madam Chair. Mr. Allen, do you represent a board, or how do you get to represent 65,000 students?
I'm unlucky, I guess. No, I'm just kidding. We have a governance structure from the student body presidents from each of the 7 state universities who are elected by the students, serve on a board that is our governing board, and then there's more of a process if you'd like me to go.
So, Madam Chair, so there's somebody in Austin or Albert Lee or Owatonna that serves on your board?
If there's a Minsky institution.
State universities. Our counterparts, the Minnesota State College Student Association represents the Owatonnas and the Austins and such.
Okay. How, Ms. Madam Chair, how do they feel Saturday. About this bill?
They don't have a lot of the dorm issues and things like that, and I don't know how they feel about it. They haven't been working on as many election stuff this year as we have.
Madam Chair, are there more of them than you?
By student population, yes. We've got about 65,000. They've got, I'll ballpark it now with enrollment growth, about 115,000.
Senator Day, just keeping in mind that, like, in my area, North Hennepin has several thousand students, but there are no dorms. Nobody lives on campus. So that wouldn't be an issue for them. And a lot of the community colleges, I don't know any that have dorms. The people who go there live there.
Madam Chair, I'm glad the private colleges got out of it. So I guess that's good enough for me. I don't know.
Senator Pat.
I would move that Senate Bill 661 as amended be recommended to pass.
And referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Sorry.
Big sigh.
I've got like five bills ahead of this judiciary that have to be heard.
They're in the omnibus mm-hmm. committee.
Yeah. As long as they don't have to go to jobs and business.
Right.
We'll get to you, John. We'll
you won't tell Senator Metzen you said that. Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 661, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary. Everyone in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
What? They want to go to judiciary.
Oh, dear. There you go.
That's good.
Oh, we're going to Senator Marty.
Up my no vote.
Senator Marty brings us Senate File 660. Senator Sieben.
I'd move the subcommittee report, Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben moves the subcommittee report on Senate File 660. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the subcommittee report is adopted. Senator Marty.
Thank you. Senate File 660 is a bill that would would make it so you would register automatically, unless you chose not to, when you get your driver's license or state ID card. And at the same time, it would also enable the Secretary of State's office to check and would require them to check a number of things related to citizenship, related to felony records, and so on, to make sure that you have that you are legitimately able to vote, and if not, to notify you that you're not allowed to. But in order to put them on the list, they would go through a whole range of things. And if I'll go through the bill real quickly, Section 1, they'd be getting the Social Security Administration would be checking a providing a death index to the Secretary of State's office so they could check residents who are registered to vote who are deceased, so they could remove them. Section 2 is people whose name was changed. The court administrator would have to regularly report electronically so they could be cross-checked against both the existing registered voter list and new applicants. And the Section 3 would be also the court administrator notifying people who were placed under guardianships or judged legally incompetent. And then Section 4 does the opposite. When somebody has their right to vote restored and their guardianship terminated, court administrator would report that. Sections 5 through 7 are being replaced with an amendment that I'm going to offer in a minute, but they deal with the issue of people with these things, allowing driver's license or state ID card number, last four digits of Social Security number, and so on, so the Secretary of State can more easily match up to make sure that people are not disqualified because of felony conviction, and also when they are reinstated, when their rights are restored. Section 8 would be, under HAVA, would require Commissioner of Public Safety to make data on citizenship available to the Secretary of State so they can cross-check that. Section 9 is the provision on the automatic registration when you apply for a driver's license or instruction permit or identification card. And at that time, you would be, unless you declined to do so, you would be registered to vote at that time. And the next page, 5, lines 5.8 on, Secretary of State then takes those applications and checks them against all these other lists that they're supposed to do. And Section 10, effective date. And we have an amendment, the A2 amendment, that the Secretary of State's office would like to have added to correct things based on concerns from the Department of Public Safety and so on. And obviously this is not, you know, this was in the subcommittee, so this is not, we can explain the amendment, and then I will move the A2 amendment, though. And I'll ask Ms. Fraser to explain it.
Senator Marty, this is the only amendment you have? Or did you have a, did you mention another amendment, or is this?
This will be the only one, I think.
This is it. Okay.
The only one we have.
Okay. Ms. Fraser, do you want to explain, or the Secretary, do you want to explain the A2 amendment?
I'd be happy to explain it, Madam Chair. Beth Fraser with the Secretary of State's office. Section 1 was added in response to a concern that you raised, Madam Chair, in the subcommittee about data that our office would receive on people who are not eligible to vote, including those under 18 who are not eligible. So this says if we're not registering them because they're not eligible, then it's private data, and so it would not be available to anyone else. Section 2 adds language to the section about the notice that we send to people who are registered, saying what has to be in the notice, clarifying that if we are more automatically registering people, that the notice has to tell them that if they're eligible, they're now registered to vote, that it's a felony to vote if you're not eligible, and that if they're not eligible, they should immediately call the voter registration office, and that the notice has to contain a list of the voter eligibility criteria so they can determine whether or not they're eligible. On 1.21, this should say it's deleting sections 6 and 7, not 5 to 7.
Madam Chair, I'll incorporate that into the amendment.
6 and 7 instead of 5 to 7. That's incorporated in your amendment, Senator Marty.
So this new section comes out of discussions that we've been having with the staff at the Department of Corrections and trying to make sure that we're setting up a system that works for them and with them. And so this, like the previous two sections, sets up a system where they would provide us with data on individuals who are 18 or older who are under their jurisdiction, and we would then determine if any of the people on the list are registered to vote and whether their record has already been challenged for felony status. Does it need to be challenged for felony status? Did they vote while it appears that they were under a felony conviction, in which case we have a problem? Or does it appear that their felony sentence has ended, in which case the challenge should be removed? And then requires that action be taken based upon which of those, if any, of those criteria are met, including notifying the county auditor, who would then notify the county attorney if someone had voted when they were not eligible to do so. Section lines 2.13 to 2.15, this goes along with the first section, adding the private data, the classification of data, in response to the concern that you raised, Madam Chair. The next section, the roster table notice.
Senator Marty, you want to make a technical amendment there to the word place?
Yes, I would like to.
To change placed, placed.
Placed, okay. I'll incorporate that in if I can.
Okay.
This section was added in part after discussion with the governor's office about this bill and trying to address any concerns that they had. One of the concerns had to do with individuals who, through this process, may have gotten registered and who weren't eligible. So trying to make it much clearer to people when they go in to vote, you need to be eligible to vote. It is a felony to vote if you are not eligible. And here is the oath that you are about to sign. So this requires a notice like that at each roster table that individuals would see as they come to sign in.
Ms. Fraser, is it a felony to register or attempt to register to vote if you're not eligible, or is it only a felony if you, regardless of whether you're on a registration list, if you actually vote?
Madam Chair, it's a felony to intentionally register if you know that you're not eligible. But if the system were changed to an opt-out system where individuals were not signing up and signing an oath saying that they were eligible to register, then somebody, if they did not opt out, and if for some reason they were not eligible and we didn't catch it, they would not have committed a felony by being registered because they did not take action to be registered.
So if somebody was registered to vote and then was convicted of otherwise felony, and they, for whatever reason, remained on the voter registration list, even though they're not eligible to vote, that in and of itself does not create an additional felony.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
The new language on 2.24 and 2.26 includes to the effective date that the Department of Public Safety, the commissioner there, also needs to certify before this is effective that their systems are up and running and have been tested and can provide us with the data that we would need for this to be effective. The final thing that this does is in the subcommittee report, there was information added that was on lines 1.26 to 1.28, talking about what had to be in the notice that was sent to voters. And we would prefer that all of the information about what has to be in that notice be in the same section. So that was added in the second section of this amendment. So we're just deleting it from that section from the subcommittee report. And that's the amendment.
Are there questions of Ms. Fraser or Senator Marty with regard to the A2 amendment with the two changes? Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, I guess I have two questions now. I'm just curious on page 1, line 15, and on page 2, line 22, there's
of
a
the amendment?
Of the amendment. There's a description of the eligibility criteria for voting, both in the notice that's sent to voters and at the roster table at each precinct. Is there any discretion about what that notice might mean? Should we tighten that up and make it prescribed so that it's clear for everyone? I mean, is the Secretary of State going to provide what that says? I mean, I'd hate to, you know, leave it up to – that's a lot of entities sending it, and it should be one description.
Madam Chair, Senator Lori, these notices are generated by the statewide voter registration system.
Okay.
So we would design the notice, and then each county, you know, clicks to cue it for that voter, but it would be standard language.
Okay. And then the last thing was you deleted from the subcommittee report lines 126 to 128, and it had an additional: the notice must provide the contact information for the county auditor, which I didn't see in section 2 that was adopted.
Jason?
I don't think I saw it there.
County auditor shall mail.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Lori, you're right. That was not added. It could be added. It is already always included on the notice, but you could require that statutorily if you wanted.
It was in the
Why did you
committee
delete
report.
It?
I didn't know.
County auditor. I mean, but they can't.
Senator Marty, why did
Madam
you
Chair,
delete it then?
The county auditor under page 1, line 10, you can see the county auditor is supposed to mail the notice to the individual, and obviously if we don't notify the county auditor, they can't mail the notice, so I think it was just implied here.
I see.
But, I mean, if we want to add it, we can add it.
I think this is a notice to the individual about how to contact the county auditor, make sure that they had a phone number or something. I mean, if we're putting a responsibility on the person to contact the auditor, we need to make sure that they do have the appropriate information to fulfill their role.
Madam Chair, that would be appropriate to add. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Senator Marty, then maybe you want to leave on the subcommittee reports lines 26 through 28 in there.
Well, Madam Chair, I think
Senator
that
Marty?
that moving it to one location, the intent of Section 2 is still valid, but we wanted to put in Section 2 in the one location everything that it must contain. And so by just moving that one additional item that was in the subcommittee report.
So, Senator Marty, would you be suggesting then that you...
I'm sure page one,
delete lines 26 to 28, but then insert the language of lines 26 to 28 where?
Madam Chair, I think you'd only need to at the before the period on line 115. You could insert, and the notice must provide the contact information for the county auditor.
Yes, that would be my suggestion, and that would be.
Mr. Bodern, does that work?
Madam Chair, looking at the language in the subcommittee report on lines 26 and 28, it might help if the notice specifically informed the voter that the voter did have the option of contacting the county auditor to correct the registration. So you might want to have that language in there as well.
So, Senator Marty, you might just want to move those three lines, all those lines, and move them
to line
115 after the first period.
Madam Chair, can we just incorporate that, or you want a amendment to the
amendment? No, you can incorporate it.
Yeah, I'd like to incorporate that into the amendment.
Well, Madam Chair, it does already say that you know, the voter should immediately call the voter registration office if the voter is not eligible or does not want to be registered to vote on the A2 amendment, lines 14 and 15. So, I mean, it is kind of duplicative there, but this second sentence from the subcommittee report wasn't reflected in the new language, to my way of thinking. The first sentence was, the second sentence wasn't. And maybe I'm getting too technical.
Well, I think it's a little bit different, however, Senator Lori, because it's in the A2, it says that the voter, the notice tells the voter to call the voter registration office if the voter is not eligible or does not want to be registered to vote. But the lines 26 through 28 says that the voter may contact the county auditor not just to remove the registration but to correct it. And there might be, you know, maybe... you know, we had that issue of moving from apartment to apartment in a building that's a different address, and maybe they catch that and they just want to correct the information that they got the apartment number wrong or something. And yes, it's sure. Not that they're not eligible or that they don't want to be registered to vote, but they want to correct the information. So maybe we could just say the notice must also inform the voter that the voter may contact the county auditor to correct the registration. The notice must provide the contact information for the county auditor. Mm-hmm.
That would be fine.
Senator Marty?
I think that would incorporate everything.
So Senator Marty would incorporate, delete lines 26 and 28, delete lines 26 and 28, but then insert the language of lines 26 through 28 absent or remove, and insert them after the first period on line 115. Is that understandable to people? It's an extra thing that the voter can tell the voter registration office that they're not eligible to vote, that they don't want to be registered, or they can correct some information. And then they have to know where to who they would tell that to. Okay, we have the A2 amendment. Is there further discussion on the A2 amendment with the changes incorporated by Senator Marty? Seeing none, all those...
Are we just on the amendment, Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Gerlach. Thank you. All those in favor of the A2 amendment with the changes incorporated, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment with the incorporated changes, A2, is adopted. Now we're on the bill. Is there, Senator Marty, do you have any other changes?
no more changes in it. I just wanted to say briefly that this bill will do much to facilitate, make it easier for people to register and to make it happen ahead of time, and so it's not election day registration. And it will, for the first time, make it easier for the Secretary of State's office to have all the data they need to cross-check it with data about convictions and disqualification for other reasons like citizenship, and it would allow them to easier cross-check for those who are deceased. So it'll make it much more accurate registration and also make it easier to register people. And this will not only save time on Election Day because it will greatly reduce Election Day registration, but it also will have significant savings. I think Hennepin County estimated it may save them $1 million a year just because they don't have to manually enter the data. When the person enters the data now, when you register to vote at the driver's license place, they send all the information that has to be all manually keyed in by the county. And again, Hennepin County estimates they'll save $1 million just from that. But I wanted to have Secretary of State Ritchie speak to the bill briefly as well, and then we're happy to stand for questions.
Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mark Ritchie, Secretary of State. In this week, this subject of modernizing voter registration is in the U.S. Senate, the subject of a number of hearings. There were big articles in the New York Times. The senior Republican Secretary of State and a senior Democratic Secretary of State wrote about it today in roll call. It's on a lot of people's minds, and it's partly a response to the need to reduce cost. It's partly a response to the accuracy that we need to be having in our voter rolls and our voter registration system. And it's also a response to just the fact that technology is evolving. We can move this forward. I discussed this bill, among other things, with the governor last week. He reminded me that the legislature, at his request, had invested $40 million into our Department of Public Safety to help lift up their computer system to really make it possible for us to do a number of new things. And we discussed a lot of the components of this. So I feel like there's a lot of momentum about this. 2 weekends ago, I was at a meeting of the senior election attorneys and researchers, and we talked about this a great deal. And the senior counsel for the John McCain campaign and the senior counsel for the Barack Obama campaign were both there, and both have expressed publicly and in meetings their belief that we need to be modernizing this system. We think this is the way that we can make this happen in Minnesota to reduce cost, to increase our accuracy and our transparency, our integrity, and also reduce a lot of hassle for citizens. So we're strongly in favor of this bill and appreciate Senator Marty's leadership. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Secretary, do all of those people you mentioned support the automatic voter registration for driver's licenses?
Madam Chair, each one of these individuals have different ideas. For example, the attorneys that are representing the campaigns have been very interested in how to make the systems automatic so that the large voter registration drives that they often have to finance would not have to take place. The ones where they're paying people to go out to bus stops, both campaigns have done that. Some people advocate the North Dakota system where you build a voter list from the bottom up. You don't have voter registration, and it's a very efficient system. And some people think of that as a superior system to ours. So everybody has a different way of thinking about the technology advances. But I think ultimately everyone is trying to understand how we can take electronic data and use it to move our system forward. Some states have not moved as far as Minnesota in terms of knowing the citizenship status of people registering to get driver's licenses. Other states are moved farther to a real ID, which Minnesota hasn't. So each state has some different aspects of this, but voter registration system needs to be modernized was the piece in roll call. The Senate hearing is on 21st century voter registration. So people are talking about this, and each state is trying to find ways to reduce costs, increase the accuracy, the integrity, but also to make it a better opportunity for citizens.
Madam Chair? Yeah. Questions for Senator Marty or the Secretary? Comments? Senator Roebling?
Thank you. Secretary Ritchie, are you saying that we would be the first state to do registration according off of driver's license?
Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling. The Secretary of State of Michigan, Terry Lynn Land, who happens to also control the driver's license system, is probably the most advanced thinking on this in the country, but it's because she controls both systems together. And I think she told me she was at 97% voter registration of their eligible citizens. So I don't know how they do it, and I don't know how they got that high. And, of course, our office does not control the driver's license system in the state, unlike Michigan. But she's the most advanced on this.
Madam Chair. Senator Roebling?
And I still have some discomfort with it. And I would like someone to explain now. You mentioned something that we have a fairly good system of identifying U.S. citizens as they register or as they get their driver's license. However, I know that there's a lot of question as to how many people do have driver's license that they've received using false information, some of the illegal residents who are driving with what looks to be like, I don't know where they get them. Maybe they get them through the system, and maybe they're made by somebody else who does that for a business. But, I still have concerns about making sure that people who are getting these driver's licenses are indeed U.S. citizens. And I'm wondering what kind of assurance you can give me that that is what is happening.
Well, Senator Roebling, that you can get a driver's license without being a U.S. citizen here on a visa, or you have a green card. In fact, we just heard a bill in transportation that asked for the designation of veteran to be applied to a driver's license if a veteran wanted to have that. And I asked that question, do you have to be a citizen to get a driver's license? You don't have to be a citizen to be a veteran. I mean, you don't have to be a citizen to enlist in our military. And you also, that bill was one that also said that if you were a foreign national here, otherwise eligible for a driver's license, and you had fought for a nation that was allied with the United States, by all the official designations and such, that you could also get a driver's license that said veteran on it. So you don't have to be a citizen to get a driver's license.
Madam Chair, you're not giving me any comfort here. Then how are we distinguishing between those who could get a driver's license and those who are U.S. citizens if we are going to automatically register those people who get driver's licenses?
And I think the Secretary has a way of eliminating those people technologically. But, Mr. Secretary, if you'd explain such people who are otherwise eligible under our laws to get a driver's license. We're not talking about illegal immigrants. We're talking about green cards, foreign nationals, people who are here under student visas or whatever they're here on. They can drive legally in the state of Minnesota, as they can in other states, in every other state as well. Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling. Yes, you have to show your citizenship status when you apply for a driver's license in Minnesota. Now there's two lists you have to show. And if you are here on a visa, that date is put on your driver's license. We use the word status check. That's the description of DPS uses. And we run lists against status check and other eligibility requirements. Being a felon, are you dead, are you a citizen or not? That's part of the process that we are talking about here. But we have also the two places, including at the final table when you're walking the roster, where you're also asked again. But generally speaking, when you apply for a driver's license in Minnesota, you are proving your citizenship status. It is certainly the case that 19 and 20-year-old young people do have ways of buying false identifications. They are doing it for a purpose. It's also true that anyone who votes illegally who's not a citizen is deported from the country. And anyone who votes illegally who's a felon and not off paper
is guilty of a second felony, and a young man just spent another 30 days in the workhouse for this violation of law this last week, was sentenced to another 30 days in the workhouse for this. So our systems are quite strong. People are prosecuted. This has not been an issue that we've had much of a problem with, but occasionally somebody who is a felon and not yet off paper does vote, and they are dealt with very severely. But in our state now, we have a very strong system of requiring citizenship status proof when a driver's license is applied for, and that's the system that we'll use.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Fraser.
Senator Roebling. The other thing that would happen under this bill is that on the driver's license, on the main part of the application, every applicant would be asked, are you a citizen, yes or no, and would have to give that information under penalty of perjury, which is the same standard that's currently used on the voter registration forms. Voters check a box, are you a citizen, yes or no. And so it's using the same standard that voters currently use to indicate their citizenship when they apply to register to vote. It just would be on the form, on the driver's license form.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And I know people who don't speak English are eligible to get driver's licenses. So on those forms, are they available in different languages? How are we sure that they understand what they're filling out?
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I've never seen a driver's license application in any other language other than English.
But, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
You can take your driver's exam, your written exam, in a language other than English. Isn't that correct?
Maybe we can ask Ms. McCormick to respond to the driver's license issues.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick, Driver and Vehicle Services Division Director. And the requirements do allow an applicant to be able to take the knowledge or the written test in other languages. Or they can have oral, they can bring in an interpreter. We offer various ways that they can take that. But in terms of the road exam, they are not allowed to have an interpreter. They must be able to recognize all road signs, and they must be able to take direction from the examiner in passing the road test. So in terms of having a driver's license, they have to be able to comprehend English and be able to take direction, or they will not pass the road test. So they do have to have a knowledge of English. The reason we offer it in the written exam is because oftentimes it's more the comprehension on the computers that in terms of written comprehension that can be a problem, and so we might have to spend quite a bit of time doing oral exams to ensure that they are understanding the meaning of the written test. So we do offer that option, but they must be able to take direction in English so that they can pass the tests.
And the application?
And in terms of the application form, we only have the application in English, and certainly our exam staff do assist if people don't quite understand the requirements so they know what they're filling out. But they do have to be able to read and be able to write the application. At this point in time, we don't have an online application that you are able to do, so they do have to be able to write their name and all the information that is required on the application in order to be able to get a driver's license. And we do ask, in terms of voter registration on the application, that they attest to their citizenship, as Ms. Fraser said. In terms of we don't check citizenship at this time because we don't have that ability to have online verification to be able to check that with the Department of Homeland Security. But you have to be able to show legal presence, as Senator Rust was saying, in order to be able to get a driver's license. So you have to either show that you're the fact that you may be here as a permanent, in permanent status in the country, if you were an asylee or a refugee, or if you're here on a temporary visa of some sort, you have to be able to show that, and we do list a status check if you're only here temporarily on the driver's license and on the driving record. And that information at this time, on a weekly basis, we send a file to the Secretary of State's office so that they can verify that. And we do the Social Security verification with the Secretary of State's office. I think it's on a monthly basis.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So we do have those types of verification that we do with the Secretary of State's office at this time.
Senator Roebling, did you have any further questions?
The Social Security number. Hmm? I'm going to the Social Security number. Is it people who have, do people who have green cards have Social Security numbers too?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, it would depend if they were working, and we have a lot of people, especially in Minnesota, that are here as temporary workers. I can think of a few different industries where when we were doing our identification rules, we heard from those industries where that's especially the case. Mayo Clinic comes to mind, and some other places where there are a lot of people over here on temporary visas. And I'm not sure if they have to have Social Security numbers. They have to have a tax identification number, I think. And so they do have tax identification numbers. And if you don't have a Social Security number on our application, you just have to you have to attest to the fact under penalty of law that you do not have a Social Security number. So that's how the application reads.
Senator Gerlach, do you have something?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move to delete Section 9. That is the automatic registration. And we've had this discussion back and forth extensively in the subcommittee, so I won't go into all of that, but there are a few of our full committee members that haven't been the beneficiaries of that discussion. And so I think it's important to point out why, another point of view on this. So I'm sure I'd like to make that motion.
Sure.
If I could speak to that then.
Senator Gerlach moves to delete Section 9, and that would include whatever else goes along with that. Okay, we all understand.
Yeah.
He moves to delete Section 9 and any language that refers to automatic registration.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Through driver's license. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty and Secretary of State Ritchie, we know we've had this discussion previously, and so this is new to you, but I get where you're going with 8 of the 9 sections of the bill. Section 10 is just the effective date, but you have 9 substantive sections. 8 of them are all related. They all make sense about updating existing voter database or registered voters' records and such. But then you got into Section 9, which is the automatic registration. And I just want to point out what the fundamental flaw is with that. Here it is. And I want to also put this in the context of I get the online registration. In fact, I support that. And there are some who wouldn't. I think that maybe that's loosening it up too much and such. I think that not allowing that is an artificial barrier that's unnecessary. So I'm not opposed to keeping with the times, so to speak. But the problem, the fundamental flaw, members, with this automatic registration is that it's a negative checkoff. You assume that the government is now going, wheels get set in motion when you have done nothing. And that is a flaw in this. That is a fundamental flaw. The government shouldn't be taking actions like that when you've done nothing. You should take an affirmative action to register to vote. You're taking an affirmative action to apply for a driver's license. You're taking an affirmative action to do these things. To have something happen without your, your affirmative, informed, full consent would be like if you got a utility bill, a phone bill, say, and it had a box on there that said, if you don't check this box, we are automatically going to add some services and add some charges and whatnot. Well, I'm sure we have probably laws on the books that prohibit that sort of practice. If we don't, if it's happening, I'm sure somebody's got a bill for that. Because we would be outraged as consumers. If things happen like that, that are kind of just tucked in, that we would be outraged by that. And the point I wanted to make is that everybody who is eligible to vote, who can register to vote, should be able to. But not being on the grid, so to speak, is also the prerogative of an individual. And we know that there will be people, we know as a fact, that people will register for, they'll sign up for the driver's license, they'll do that, and they will automatically be registered to vote. And they may not catch that. And yes, they're getting something in the mail that says, if this isn't what you want, then you have to tell us. But these wheels have been put in motion. Now the onus is on the person, when they may be like, what? What is this all about? Or they may disregard it or whatever. But it's all irrelevant, because none of that should have happened until the citizen made that affirmative decision, informed, knowledgeable, saying, I'm registering to vote. There it is. Well, they wouldn't tear it, but they'd check it. They got to make that affirmative consent. And we're putting this in motion here that it's just going to happen automatically. And that's just fundamentally wrong. The government shouldn't be doing that. We wouldn't allow private business to do this to people. We shouldn't allow the government to do this. So, members, just take out Section 9. The other 8 sections are all improvements. I think we all can agree on them. And let's pass the bill. Why jeopardize all the other good parts here with a piece that is very controversial? We know as it's going forward, it's going to meet resistance. It's going to be difficult to get signed into law. I'm not saying impossible. I don't know what discussions you've had with the governor's office on this or what. But why not just take these 8 sections? Let's pass it. And if you want to do this as a separate bill, fine. We'll argue about that. In this bill, I think we need to delete Section 9. And leave it at that.
Okay, Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach points out that voters can choose one way or another. 85 to 90% of the public's already they want to be registered to vote. So that making the default that people want to be registered to vote is pretty much the way people want it to be. Most people, again, the vast majority, are registered, want to be registered to vote. And this is a matter of simple, making sure it happens at the right time. If I'm registered to vote and I switch addresses, get a new driver's license, and we don't do it because, well, I'm already registered to vote, so I'm not going to check the box to do it, it's going to make things messier that way. We have this happen many times. Young men, 18 years old, when they get their driver's license, they are registered for selective service, whether they want to be or not. Only there's no checkoff. It's just mandatory. I think it's absolutely reasonable to have this happen, and it makes sense because there will be a handful of people who will object to it, and they have the chance to opt out of it. But for the vast majority of people, they want to do it. And so we're making it simpler, and I think this will save the money. It will make this all fits together in making the registration system up to date and accurate and fair. And I understand your objection, but I just simply disagree.
Is there, I think the argument's been laid out. Mm-hmm. Is there further discussion? Senator Roebling.
Well, Madam Chair, I agree that that is a very good argument. Isn't it possible, and maybe they do it now, that they have voter registration forms at the driver's license bureaus? Do they make those available for people? Is there a form that they could affirmatively attach to the application for driver's license that is fully acknowledging that they want to register to vote at that same time? But they would actually have to affirmatively attach it. But then once that was on there, you could take the information that is on the driver's license that's going to automatically be keyed in anyway and then give that back to the Secretary of State's office.
There's a box on the driver's license.
Pardon?
There's a box on the driver's license application to check.
To check that you want that done.
Yep.
So it's
the answer is yes.
There is a box on the form.
Yes.
That or will be one.
No, there is.
There's no. If you affirmatively want to register, you check it.
But we wouldn't even put that on there anymore? This bill would say we're not going to put that on there anymore? We're just going to give this to everybody?
Madam Chair, Senator Obling, your suggestion, which is that driver's license bureaus could have other voter registration card, would be in addition to the current system, which has a box on it. And, of course, they can always be typed in, and this is the source of the current millions of dollars that local governments are spending on this and a lot of errors in the system, which is why we want to make the system more accurate by using this approach. However, the proposal creates an oath about citizenship and a different kind of oath appearance so that you could opt out, which is why we often call it opt out of the system. I might point out that our good friends in North Dakota use a number of specific lists to build their voter list, and that approach is one of the many ways that states now are using to make the system more automatic. But no one is registered automatically when a name comes forth now, whether it comes through the current system or typed. There are a number of databases that we run them against. What's really terrific about this proposal is that we start out with a clean, comprehensive list that's properly typed and properly addressed that then we can run against felon lists, status on citizenship, and other lists. Now we have handwritten forms of between 500,000 and 600,000 on an election day. They have to be typed in. Errors are made when a name is mistyped. That person is not found when we run it against a felon list. That person is not found when we run it against the citizenship list. So this moves us to have clean lists. This gives us the possibility of accurate lists to use for all the other sections. And so you could spend millions of dollars typing in names from a phone book. That would be another, you know, way that people could indicate they want it to be. You know, they can mark their name and turn that in. But the typing and all of that is exactly what we want to try to eliminate in this process.
Senator Carlson?
Madam Chair, and I'm not sure who to address this to, but how do you get registered for jury duty?
Good question. I don't know.
Jury duty comes from a list of registered voters.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, the list can be derived from a variety of sources. My understanding is that the primary source is the list of people that have driver's licenses. Mm-hmm. They may use the voter registration list, but my understanding is that that isn't usually done.
Thank you.
I've never been addressed.
Okay, I think people understand the issue. Is there further discussion? We have Senator Gerlach's motion to delete Section 9 and any accompanying language. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. We have Senate File 660 as amended before us. Any further discussion? Anybody else that wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Erin Sepp. I'm the project director for the organization Heartland Democracy, and I just wanted to briefly speak.
We need you to be very brief because some of our members have other obligations and other committees.
Absolutely, absolutely. So thank you. I just wanted to reiterate some of the points that have already been made, that it would reap great fiscal savings for the state. This sort of system would be very resource efficient and help ensure that we have very clean and complete voter rolls and that only eligible voters are actually put on the rolls, which in turn will help to create a greater, foster a greater trust in government because voters know that they can show up on election day and cast their votes. Voters themselves will have a few direct benefits of this sort of system. There'll be shorter lines at the polls. They'll benefit from more effective GOTV and voter education efforts, and overall, it'll just be less hassle. So that's I'll conclude with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Day.
Madam Chair, are there a lot of election vote or bills moving forward, or are we?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Madam Chair, nothing to do with present administration. Probably
yes.
was many
yes.
back, but.
No, there are a number of separate bills.
I personally feel that we're kind of the laughing stock of the United States. with our last election, mm-hmm. and taking this long and whatever we have that are the underpinnings of whatever we have to do. Somewhere along the line, I'm hoping by the end of the
session. Senator Day, there are a number of bills that address recounts, that address runoff elections, that talk about absentee voting, early voting, where there are a number of separate bills. Some campaign finance reforms as well. They're
Madam
coming.
Chair, I think myself and a lot of Minnesotans.
We're trying not to get 100% dose of that.
Thought we had this
once.
Wonderful, wonderful system, and we were all, you know, patting ourselves on the back. And I think after watching this whole thing, I've come to the conclusion we didn't have a very good system. We don't have a very good system.
Well, you'll have a chance to respond to some of the changes that are being proposed, a number of them.
That's good.
From the Secretary of State, as a matter of fact. So we have Senator Marty's motion that Senate File 660, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion? And refer to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much. The next bill on the calendar is Senate File. We're going to take we'll do my bill last. Senator Salzman, we'll take yours next. You know, members, we really do need people to.
I'm just going to check in at.
Okay, we need people to vote on these bills. We got two left. We've tried to go very fast.
Thank you, Madam Chair and
Senator
members
Salzman.
Of the committee. I'm here today with Senate File number 866, and Senator Olson has been almost a co-chief author with me, so I'd like to have her here at the table for moral support today.
That's just fine. Welcome, Senator Olson.
Senator
Salzman, as I understand it, the bill is here because of Section 6.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Rules and legislative review. And if you would give us maybe a two-sentence overall description of the bill and then talk about the rulemaking.
Yes. The bill itself will require a new test for pre-service teachers that will really require our new teachers to show greater competency in very specific reading strategies that currently are not being done, is not included in the test. And there has been some rulemaking going on regarding these reading strategies, and we've had some concern as to that process as we've moved this forward. And so this specific piece in Section 12 is us hovering over the process. We are not impeding it, but it is an opportunity for us. And as you had the agency rulemaking
oversight
piece last year, I went to it, and I remember very distinctly that, you know, one of the pieces was that if we are dissatisfied with the rulemaking, the legislature can always replace the rulemaking with a statutory solution. I would prefer not to do that. I would prefer that if we're not pleased with the rulemaking, that we have the opportunity to sort of follow the process. We've checked with the Board of Teaching, and actually these dates that were put in will not prevent them from moving forward with the rulemaking, but it does allow us to just kind of keep in touch with what is happening with the process.
Let's see, so this is very interesting, this retroactive effective date. Has that ever happened before, Mr. Bonner, on rulemaking?
Madam Chair, I can't think of a recent instance. It may be that it occurred some time ago. But.
Senator Salzman, why do you need them retroactive? Why do you need a retroactive effective date?
That's a good question, Madam Chair. And my guess is that we took last year's bill, which actually we passed as the Senate passed this bill in our omnibus education policy bill twice unanimously. And I believe that probably at the time when this was passed last year, was February 1st, and that could probably be corrected to whenever this bill is passed. And I think the idea was that we would be able to follow this process.
Madam Chair, I would think I don't think this works like this. I mean, they have to give the rules to the committees by April 1st, but what if the bill doesn't pass until May 18th?
Well,
how does that work?
Madam Chair, they can't adopt rules until the legislature has adjourned, which is not till after. So structurally, there are.
These are the proposed rules.
Why wouldn't you want to make this going forward?
Madam Chair.
And say that the Board of Teaching submitting the proposed rules July 1st to, or if you don't have an effective date, but, well, you can say that the section is effective the day after enactment, and then the Board of Teaching must submit proposed rules within
February. So perhaps, Madam Chair, if I could suggest something.
5 months after enactment, and be silent on the board not doing it until they adjourn. I mean, there's a regular rulemaking process, and there's so many months in which the rules have to be taken up. Senator Sulzman, I'm kind of really uncomfortable with this language.
Well, perhaps, Madam Chair, if I might suggest, we could probably delete the first sentence and just leave the board may not adopt rules until the legislature has adjourned the 2009 regular session.
And is that because they already have some rulemaking authority in this? I mean, they have general rulemaking authority.
Madam Chair.
But you don't want them to adopt rules with regard to reading instruction until after the end of the 2009 session. Is that?
Madam Chair, could I address
yeah,
that?
Yeah, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, the rulemaking process is about to be, the rules have been, the proposed rules are ready to go to the state register, I think with the statement of need and reasonableness that is in preparation, and probably will be within the next few months while we're still in session. They will be known to us,
mm-hmm.
and we're not trying to inhibit. We're, as she said, we're trying to hover over that process. The process and the length it takes, they will not actually occur until after the legislative session. But I think this was a statement that we do want to watch what is going on, because mm-hmm. we want to be sure that the rules that are passed are consistent with the statutes that we have. We've had it for 8 years. The underlying bill, the bill that before it, is amplifying and clarifying that further. And I believe we wanted to communicate an expectation that the rulemaking process is going to lead to a more effectively prepared teachers coming into our classroom, so that we can get off this constant and consistent low performance in terms of the reading in our by learning to read by third grade. We've got Ms. Thompson is here, and I think she's got the specifics on the end, the tip of her tongue as to why we want to do this and why we want to remain, have it remain consistent, that we're not trying to stop the rulemaking process. They are going forward. The actions we took last year actually put back in place things that some were recommending be removed, so that we could have that, and it did have its effect even if it didn't become law. And this we just want to continue to have that,
Senator Olson,
that pressure.
Senator Sulzman, we just need to make the language work
yes.
here. And so taking your suggestion, how about the board may not adopt rules regarding licensure in reading instruction until the legislature has adjourned the 2009 regular session
and then make the effective date of this Section 6 the day following enactment. Mr. Bodern, does that?
Madam Chair, I believe that would work. I don't know if there's any concern about covering the, if you believe the rules will be submitted during this session, then I suppose that would accomplish the intent. If there's a possibility that the legislature might adjourn before that date, you might want to include the 2010 session if there's an effort to provide legislative review.
Madam Chair, do you want it for 2009, or do you want to say that they can't adopt them until 2010?
Right. Well, Madam Chair, I think the 2009, because we would like to move this process forward, okay. And if we wait until 2010,
so would you accept the amendment that I
inhibit the process
that I,
and we'd
the
like
language
to move
that I suggested?
Yes.
Senator Olsen moves to on section line 5.2 to strike 5.234. And 5 up to the period, and then insert on line 5.5 after the word rules regarding licensure and reading instruction. And then on line 5.7, Senator Olsen further moves to strike retroactively effective from February 1st, 2009, and insert, well, I guess just strike retroactively and from February 1, 2009, and insert following the word effective the day following enactment. All those in favor of that motion,
Madam
please
Chair?
Say. Yes.
I'm not sure if I caught this when you read, when you described your motion. I think it would help on line 5.5. Where it refers to rules, refer to the proposed rules.
The proposed rules. That would be Senator Olsen's motion. All those in favor of that motion to amend, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
Thank
is there
you very
a further
much, Madam Chair.
Discussion? And we really don't need testimony. On this bill, Senator Olsen has a question.
I do. Did you guys address 4.26?
We're only talking about rulemaking, Senator.
Oh, okay, because they got the date problem there, too. The date's already passed.
Where are you looking?
4.26.
No, that's March 1 of 2010.
Oh, boy.
That's the gas bubble. That's the gas bubble.
Okay. Senator Olsen moves that Senate file 866 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Education. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Salson, Senator Olson. Senator Laurie, thank you very much.
Senator Rust will take up Senate file 729.
Senate file 729 attempts to or proposes to streamline the human resources part of the statute that affects Hennepin County. I have an amendment that I would like to offer. It is the
A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment.
This is the first time this bill has been heard. It's an author's amendment. Everyone understand? All in favor of the A1 amendment? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, we have the bill in shape.
Members, there is a summary coming from the county of the bill, as well as the summary provided by Mr. McGowan. The summary provided by the county, I think, gets a little bit more rationale for why they believe these. This modernization is desirable. First of all, looking at the first bullet point, that it's going to provide some flexibility to the county in response to the needs of the county organization, and also more efficiently, bypassing some duplicative stops for some of the decisions that are just really often turn out to be no more than rubber stamps and just aren't needed. And then secondly, proposing some changes to the Hennepin County Human Resources rules that were actually approved by the County Human Resources Board and also by the County Board of Commissioners, but they also need legislative authority to do that. And the four things that are listed there are the changes that they would like made to the Human Resources Act, which governs Hennepin County. One of them is to clarify the responsibility when a demoted employee fails probation to allow that person to be terminated for cause rather than return to the former higher level job class. And the amendment that we adopted clarifies what actually would happen in that instance. The second one simply allows the HR director and the department director to establish the length of the probationary period for a job class because it's felt that they know the job better than and not making it more than 12 months, but they know the job better, and to involve the HR board is just simply time consuming and not needed. And then the third thing is to create this panel of three randomly selected department directors to hear non-disciplinary human resources rule violation. And the current rule involves, again, this Human Resources Board, in a lot of details that just really aren't necessary, and the change streamlines it. And then number four bypasses a step that's currently undertaken, and that is that the HR board as well as the county board has to approve compensation plans. Of course, we know that county employees that are organized, they do so under a labor contract. And this change only applies to the non-organized employees. We have the responsible person here from Hennepin County to answer any questions if you need further information.
Any questions of members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
The only question I have is, you know, how come Hennepin, I mean, and I know this happened a long time ago, but why Hennepin County has all these rules in our state statutes is just beyond me.
Senator Rust?
I don't understand it either, but we have our own statute, and the state likes to, you know, be in loco parentis for Hennepin County and truly the nanny state for Hennepin County.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. McGowan?
Just let everyone know Hennepin County is not the only one. It's Ramsey, St. Louis, Dakota. I think there's another one.
Too.
So Hennepin County has the most, but they're not the only one.
Some of mine sometime could use some, maybe. I don't know.
So, Mr. Chairman, if there are no questions, I would move that Senate File 729 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rust moves Senate File 729 as amended be recommended to pass. Everyone understand the motion? All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, you may adjourn the committee.
There being no further business before the committee, it stands adjourned. Good work.